Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of Is It Funny? I'm your host, Dr. Kate Leary, and this episode we are doing more Dagenham dialogues because, of course, one was not enough. Oh, and I should say a word about transcripts. I am working on finding an easy way to manage the transcripts, so hopefully I can get those up quite soon. All right, the dialogues this week. Again, Pete and Dud, for those of you who are falling upon this episode by accident. Pete and Dud, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, did a number of dialogues for the program, not only but also, and some of which are available only in the script, not actually in performance, not audio or video. And the two I want to look at today are two of those. And the first one is on music. One of the things that I find interesting about the Pete and Dud dialogues is that they might seem in some ways to be punching down. They are stupid people. And sometimes, you know, it's not people's fault. They don't know something. Ignorance. Ignorance is not really the problem. Deliberate ignorance is the problem. And people who are proud of their ignorance, let's look around us right now. That's evil. And that's awful. And that's unpleasant to deal with. So what's funny about this is that the two of them are very strong in their assumption that they do know quite a bit. And, of course, they're easily revealing how little they know. The one on music, one of the disappointments of not being able to have at least some version of the sound of this dialogue is wondering what choice they went with in pronouncing Debussy. Did they go with the French? Did they go with the English? Did they go with the American? It would be interesting to know. And if they differed too, because sometimes that can be a really great comedy motif where people keep repeating the same thing in different pronunciations as a kind of, you know, subtle argument. So they're listening to this piece, which they call wonderful. Dud calls it absolutely, absolutely glorious, this music. This is Debussy's La Mer. And part of what, as we're trying to conjure up both this scene, this dialogue, and the music playing behind it, is Pete saying Debussy is so brilliant at conjuring up a whole scene with the use of his instruments. You can almost see the scene. And of course, in describing these, I suppose I'm trying to do the same thing. And for a moment, you're sort of caught up in it. Maybe you're imagining it too, and you're picturing the ocean and sort of the waves moving and the sound of it. Maybe the scream of the gulls. Dundee is always full of the scream of gulls. And so Pete's saying, yes, you can almost see it. There she is. Debussy's mother comes into the room, a silver tray covered with a silver teapot, silver cups, and Dud adds, and silver hair. Yes, silver hair on the mother. She comes in. Debussy, how can I be doing this? I'm wanting to say Debussy. Sitting there on the sofa in his little blue smock. She pours the tea. Do you hear the tea being poured? Yes, you can almost hear the cream going into the cup. Not too little, not too much. It's wonderful how they paint this picture of mother as, Kate Bush immediately comes to mind, mother stands for comfort. But this picture of mother as pouring the tea, why Debussy should be in a blue smock, because he's, you know, relaxing at home and it's just right. Everything is just right. A bird twittering its rondelay of summer mirth. You know, here is this very pretentious sort of arty language that they're both making fun of by putting it in the mouths of these two, you know, characters who are far from that arty world. But also this puncturing both of that kind of pretension and their idiocy that they're not even recognizing, that they don't know what they're talking about. The flute takes up the theme of the bird. Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Can almost see the myriad hues of its feathers. Beautiful. And Mum gets on with the ironing. So back to this image of La Mer versus La Mer. The bread baking in the oven. Okay, enough of that. Turn it off. So they can take this sublime music, but only for so long. And then they have to kind of stop it. and just get rid of it, because they cannot really put up with this kind of quality for any time at all. And then, of course, ironically, they turn to wanting to learn to play the piano. And Pete saying, I often wish my mother had forced me to learn the piano when I was young. Well, I don't know, forced, but certainly Dudley took up the piano very young and, I mean, played his way into Oxford. So this is no small feat, although he was there for playing the organ, not the piano, which is interesting in itself. No, I'm not going to make the obvious joke there. But Dud sang too, if only she'd force me to play, force me to be a genius. And again, this very difficult sort of interplay between the acknowledged comedy genius and the clearly genius piano player. I mean, Dudley Moore did some amazing jazz improvisations and jazz work that was recorded that's really fantastic. And you think, why did he bother going into movies when he could play music like this? But, you know, there's never enough. And if you had done this, of course, the suggestion for Pete, if you had done this, you know where you would be, in Vegas with some blonde girl. And does this, yeah, playing that Latin American boogie. Latin American, I'm not sure.
But of course, Dud sang too that he used to hate people who played the piano, like Enid Armstrong, you know, someone in the neighborhood. Oh, Enid, she had a gift for the piano, didn't she? And Dud talks about, you know, going down and playing football and seeing her through the window playing. She always had the window open, even if it was freezing cold, just so people could hear her playing the rustle of spring, showing off. You know, and again, you wonder how much of this is some kind of commentary on Dud's own experience as a piano-playing young man. Then back to Pete's obsession with wonky bodily parts, I guess we could say. Enid had a wonderful ear for music. Oh, yes. Wonderful, wonderful. Left one. Yeah, the right one was completely useless. A terrible ear, her right one, blocked up with wax. She could have been a professional, but, you know, concert pianist. Unfortunately, her musical career, as you know, came to an end when she fell under a bus. She never played another note after that. Never breathed another breath, did she? It's, again, the humor comes out of the juxtaposition between your expectation, like, oh, she was hit by a bus. Oh, it's a shame. It put an end to her career. Well, it put an end to her life, too, which is not really what you want to hear. Poor Enid. Died under the influence of a bus. But suffering can be a wonderful boon to the musician, as Pete argues too, which is very funny. And they go off on this tangent about Beethoven, who of course was born in Flanders, as we all know. His mother was a weaver and his father was a wearer. He was a happy young child, but of course, as he was composing in Bruges, you know, as you know, the tapestries caught on fire. 14th century, I love their depiction of the Middle Ages, the hawks on the wrist and everything. He wrote jingles, he wrote lighthearted tunes, he wrote, you know, advertisements for the family weaving shop, apparently. But then he was the thunderstorm that struck him down. He sank to the bottom and peered over the abyss of insanity, but he crawled back from the pit and became a new man. And saw that life was misery and suffering and suddenly started composing really wonderful stuff and refused to do his laundry or let anyone come in. So this picture of Beowulf as someone suffering and becoming deaf mostly because his laundry piled up around him is just a wonderful sort of absurd image that they really go to a great deal of to develop. One of the interesting coincidences, or I don't know, we could call it precog maybe, that comes up when they're talking about how music can conjure up a scene from the past. And Pete mentions Ravel's Bolero, which of course plays a important part in the movie 10, which really propels Dudley into Hollywood stardom. And which of course reminds him of Eileen Latimer, who came around to tea one day and smashed the record over his head. They decide to flip over the record and hear the other side of Debussy's Mother. The dialogue on sex
deals with this now familiar dynamic of both
punishment and shame combined with completely unrealistic fantasy, and begins, of course, with the alarming news that Pete has found something objectionable in Dud's sandwich box. And, of course, it's Blauberger's Encyclopedia of Sexual Knowledge, which, again, how are you supposed to find out information? As Spaced told us, unless people leave magazines behind at the bus stops, it's certainly familiar. You might connect this also to a bit of a chat, which is available on audio and video, and covers some of the same ground in a very funny way, and how sex is treated as both a mystery, something shameful and yet irresistible. And so, of course, you know, having hidden this book away, Pete, of course, shows his greater knowledge of the subject by having read up to page 3001, which is apparently the last page, and saying, well, it's actually quite good and wonderfully informative about sex through the ages. And, of course, this is a great opportunity to go back and retell the story of Genesis and how Adam and Eve were hanging around in the Garden of Eden until the snake appears. They didn't know they were naked until up comes a serpent, as some authorities have it. As some authorities have it. What a wonderful phrase. And so up comes a serpent and says, here's an apple. Lay your teeth into that. And then, ha, you're new. You're completely nude. And laughing at them. And they ran off and embarrassed and tried to cover themselves with, again, cover themselves with mulberry leaves. Which is a wonderfully specific and completely absurd suggestion. And then, of course, as soon as they covered themselves, they you know, became attracted to each other and tore all the leaves off. And where is it, Dud saying, you know, once you've got clothes on, you're more attractive to other people. And, of course, an opportunity to bring up not only Aunt Dolly, but Uncle Bert. And Pete saying, Aunt Dolly really is at her most attractive when she's completely covered in wool and has a black veil over her face. So again, this sort of inherent fear of older women. And bringing Dud to ask Pete, you know, what's your ideal woman? And he says, well, above all others, I covet the elfin beauty. Here, medievalists will all think of Elena. The gazelle slim, elfin beauty, very slim, very slender, but all the same, still being endowed with a certain amount of dot, dot, dot. And Dud, of course, filling in the blank with busty substances. The phrase probably more than any associated with them, other than funny, funny. And Dud saying, well, he likes the same sort of thing, although actually he likes the sort of woman who throws herself on you and tears your clothes off with rancid sensuality, rancid. So again, this denigration and attraction at the same time. And of course, it always eventually goes back to the schoolyard, which, again, this source of both ignorance and mystery and horror and undeniable curiosity. And talking about the childhood friend who taught him the worst word in the world, the most disgusting word in the world, so filthy, nobody's allowed to see it except bishops. Again, the church not as any kind of religious location, but as a source of authority and punishment. And the word, of course, is bastard, which Dud still doesn't know the meaning of and asks Pete to explain. You can only get in with a medical certificate to the library that has the book where you can go in and read the definition under that great dusty B, and find the word in all its horror, child born out of wedlock. And Dud like, oh, what's a wedlock? And of course, a wedlock, Dud, is a horrible thing. It's a mixture of a steam engine and a padlock, and some children are born out of them instead of through the normal channels. And it's another one of the filthiest words in the world. And so they talk about going to the library and looking up dirty words, which, again, it's so childlike and so in contrast to their image that they want to project of being, you know, men of the world and knowledgeable, and clearly they're anything but. And so they talk about how books, and especially how novelists, can make romantic tales portraying sexual endeavors seem so much better than the real thing. And of course, the irony, of course, is the novelists that they choose to demonstrate the beauty of romance is Neville Shute, probably best known for On the Beach, in A Town Called Alice, which is the book they choose to show this sensual power. So they reenact this moment from the novel, and from the hardcover version, page 81. If you go down to the library, it falls open to that page. It's a description set in Australia, Dud. And there's this ash-blonde girl, Tina. And again, the specificity of the book and opening to that page, in the same way that if you pick up any copy of Ulysses from a library, it goes right to Molly Bloom's monologue. So a certain amount of truth involved here. And so they go through and describe this scene where she's standing on the runway at the aerodrome waiting for her rugged Aussie pilot to come, the bronzed Tim Bradley. And it's very hot. Cicadas are rubbing their legs together, making that strange noise. And throughout this, Dud makes the sound effects, which Pete acts very irritated about, that nasty noise which is coming from your mouth at this very moment. And so she's covered in dust. She's got dust on her knees, dust on her shoulders, dust on her bust, Dud puts in. Yes, dust on her bust, as you will rightly point out. It's very dusty. It's very hot, hot and dusty. And suddenly out of nowhere, the clouds open. So it rains, and Dud doing his thunderclap impression. And so she's dusty, and she's suddenly covered with this cold rain. Her wonderful frail form is outlined against the poplin. And she cups her ear to hear as she hears the sound of the plane coming. And the plane lands. Her damp dress is blown up by the wind of it. And then the bronze pilot takes her, and off they go. And the chapter ends with three dots. What do those three dots mean, Pete? Well, in Shute's hand, three dots can mean anything. And this use your own imagination. Conjure the scene up yourself. And they don't have the ability, they don't have the imagination to actually produce it. So they'd say, well, it's no good looking up bosom if it only says sea bus. But it's nice to read all the same. It gives you something to do. And there, in a nutshell, is the essence of these two characters. They don't have any imagination. They don't have any experience. They don't have any interest in pursuing the reality. They're quite happy with this very confused and incomplete fantasy. And that's enough. Well, maybe fantasy is a refuge that many of us find ourselves indulging in these days. Reality is less than optimal. All right. See you next time.